All right. Well, welcome everybody to the GC On Demand podcast. As you may know, my name is Eric Wright. I'm at Disco Posse on Twitter for the most part. That's where you find me. I'm also Disco Posse in the Green Circle community. And I'm very lucky today because I've got a super guest who's a big community advocate, great contributor, and even cooler, he's also named Eric. So if you don't already know Eric Windisch, we're going to introduce you to him today and talk a little about previous projects and some really cool stuff that's going on, Rao, on something you're about to find out called IOPipe. So with that, Eric, welcome aboard, and why don't you introduce yourself and tell folks where they can kind of find you online and stuff.
Okay. I've been working on several open source projects over the years. Most well-known projects would be OpenStack. Was one of the early contributors to that back in, I guess, the Cactus days or pre-Cactus days, which would be like early 2011, I think, or 2010, I can't remember. And it was a while ago. And then early with Docker as well. So I moved over to Docker in January 2014 and was working on OpenStack drivers for that. I worked with several others in founding the Magnum project, which is an OpenStack containers effort. And then I continued at Docker for a bit, and I worked as a security lead for some time. And now I'm off doing IOPipe. And and IOPipe is serverless, right? So that's kind of the maybe the new hotness that everybody's talking about, right? But I want to create some interesting solutions here.
Yeah, and it's neat that you've gone through this like perfect evolution to land where you're at. I like somewhere in, I think it was in your LinkedIn description, it talks about you basically you developed one of the first PaaS, you know, platforms, and that real early adopter view you've had and that participation is interesting, because there's not a lot of folks who've evolved like from place to place and yet have always been kind of on that leading edge of it. How did you come to do that? Like, what is there something inside Eric's head that says, all right, this is stabilized too much. I've got to do something new.
probably is. So actually my very first industry job, I was working at a small hosting company, but there are actually two interesting people there, one of which is relevant. The one that's not relevant was actually Brett Spender, or Spencer. He is the leader of the GR Security project. And then the other developer, who is probably a little bit more relevant to this, is Nick Costin at cPanel. And and what he was doing was building this automation for web hosting. And he ended up later building cPanel as a company. But, I got this early kind of exposure to a culture where we were building the security and building, or theoretically building the security a certain way, and we're definitely building the automation in a certain way. There's certain things about that I was unhappy with, and actually on the security side as well. And this is back in 2001 to 2002. So come 2003, I decide that I want to do my own hosting company and I want to build in security in a better way. So I built something that kind of looks like a platform as a service, and you did something that looks kind of like containers but wasn't, because it was 2003. And so users would have their own web service. So they would have Java users, and they'd have their own Java processes, and it was all on a shared machine. But back then, everybody ran as a single user on a single web service. So even as rudimentary as that was, it was a fairly decent advantage at the time. That enables to do things also like mod Perl hosting and eventually fast CGI hosting and so forth, that we were able to adopt all these technologies faster, right? Because we had this container-ish approach, and we had like reverse proxies and things that nobody was doing, and then evolve this into, well, what's the next step, right? Because I wanted containers is what I wanted, but since containers really didn't evolve, and there were some solutions, but they weren't anything that I really liked, we did virtual machines, and virtual machines were great. We started doing that in 2006. And we were able to do that at a price that nobody else can do because I was building this horizontally scaling service. So we had WordPress.com was an early customer of ours. And through that sale, I kind of, realized this horizontal scaling provides a lower cost basis, right? So we said, let's do a Walmart of hosting. And we're going to make these VMs. We're going to make them really cheap, and we'll make them self-service. And turned out Amazon was also doing this. But
That little company, eh?
but this, this is, we're doing it right at the same time. And so I kind of evolved these concepts. And in fact, I even had a serverless product in 2010. And I couldn't quite sell it because nobody quite got the idea. Nobody, I couldn't convince people, why do you want, like, why would I want to just give you functions and run them in the cloud so that I can control your infrastructure, because that was kind of the main selling point was, well, you can talk to our MySQL as a service, you can talk to our message queue as a service, you can talk to our web hosting service, and you can spawn, these virtual machine instances. And you can save these functions in the cloud and you can run them on demand. Yeah, nobody quite got that in 2010. So
It's the challenge of being ahead of the curve is unfortunately that curve doesn't pay on that part of the or they don't understand it, right? It's neat to watch the community finally catch up though, in a way, right? Like you where you suddenly go like, ah, you want to go back and say, see, I told you.
Exactly. So I decided to kind of go back, leave the entrepreneurial field for a little bit, and take the kind of the skills and talents I had grown building all of this infrastructure into kind of selling that on the market and using that to actually get employed and make real money, helping other companies do these things, build out the infrastructure, kind of hoping that the serverless thing would eventually, become mass market and I can get in early enough on that. So that's kind of where I am. I kind of saw serverless finally coming to market and left Docker of all places, to do this. And, we can make something of it.
Yeah, and it's neat how I like that you've wrapped security as a major portion of all the pieces you've done throughout your history. And that's often the last piece that folks think of. They like the automation, they like this the ease of use. And then at the end they go, oh, right, we should backfill some security features in this because we've like that, but it should never be the last thought. How did you learn to be security focused as a core part of everything you built?
No. So when I learned how to program, it was back in the 90s, and I started with actually Commodore 64 manuals, and I moved on to some like SAMS 21 Days C++ book or something, and then of course the KNR book. But what this taught me were how to write code, but not how to really program. And I think the first thing that really taught me about practical programming was applied cryptography. And that was kind of my Bible, my first real Bible for how to do, practical, algorithm development, how to, put together code that does something, not just what is the syntax, right? Because, KNR is mostly a syntax book, more than anything. And so, I really came into my career approaching things and having thoroughly digested applied cryptography at an early age. I think I bought that book at like 15 or 16. And that just kind of became, I guess my approach. But the other thing, right, is that infrastructure services, web hosting, all the whole premise, right, of these infrastructure services is to provide multi-tenancy backed by, security primitives that restrict and limit these users, right, like their interaction between each other while being able to maximize that tenancy, right? So we want to squeeze as many users into as much hardware as we can and maximize profits and maximize margins while also making it secure, right? And one side of that is infrastructure, and the other side of that is security. And if you don't have both of them, you don't have a product.
Yeah, and what we find often is that people, they go to release on the idea of like the functionality, and then the security becomes the reason why people get out, because they learn the hard way. And so talk about, containers and, when you joined Docker, what was your sort of hope in what you were doing as you joined on, and how did that go while you were at Docker, and how do you see that container ecosystem going right now?
Yeah, well, so I joined Docker relatively early. They were still kind of in that transition from dot cloud. I don't recall where my first paycheck came from, but I think the dot cloud logo might have been on that. I think officially the company had changed names, but logos and payrolls and everything, may have still been in transition. I am not quite certain.
Yeah.
But it was very close to the transition period. And and the market at the time didn't quite figure it out. I mean, I had figured it out. I actually had known Solomon since 2009, and I'd actually seen what was effectively a Docker demo back then. So when Solomon gave the team over, I was at Cloud Scaling previously, and he gave a demo over there, and he gave this demo of Docker. I'm like, well, isn't this what you had 4 years ago, right? And but it was rewritten, right? It started from scratch, rebuilt it, and I was already sold, right? I had concerns about the security, and I knew for this to be the right play, it had to be secure, because that's the whole premise, right? Is that Docker, in a way, is a security product. I mean, it's not sold as such, but again, right, it's this infrastructure plus security is what makes the product, and if you don't have both, it's not usable. So I really had some certain concerns about it, and I wanted to see those things be solved, because I knew that there was a strong market need for this. And it was really frustrating that over all these years, this thing still hadn't been productized. And so finally Solomon's productizing it, and I'm like, okay, that's it. And I was ready to leave Cloud Scaling at the time. I was already on my mind. So took me probably a good still 6 months or something before, I ended up being ready to actually make the jump that I had been thinking about, and did. And nobody, again, at the time, right, like it was still early where the market was still figuring it out. I mean, while I was at Docker, we did the first DockerCon something like 6 months after the fact, 6 months into my tenure there. And it was interesting, right? Because we had like 500 attendees, 500 more on the waiting list, and there was really less than standing room at the first DockerCon. You couldn't really like it felt like at a concert, right? The mosh pit.
Yeah, yeah.
it was like as if there was a stage, and there was like a big star there, and you couldn't move. It was really that tight and constrained. There was so little space. And yeah, I mean, it just took off like a rocket. And it's funny because when you're in that rocket, it doesn't feel that way. You don't see that growth. At least it didn't for me, and I think for many of the others, it didn't. Right, we didn't really see how it was taking off from inside the ship.
I'm gonna pick out a word, and I don't want to walk you into a like one versus the other thing, but you mentioned rocket and talking containers. What are your thoughts on what are your thoughts on how the container ecosystem in general, how there's sort of multiple offerings coming together, and again, like I don't want to say one product is better, worse, or whatever, but I just containers as an ecosystem I find are very interesting, and it's neat to see. Are you happy with kind of how the wide ecosystem is developing?
I think that it's good for there to be competition. I mean, the lack of competitors is usually a warning sign, for, say, investors and so forth. So it's good that there's competition, actually. it's better if that competition is aligned in a certain way so that the industry as a general is moving, you know, in the right direction. And that is not vicious, you know, competition, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, I think there was a time, right? I mean, you know, you had blogs going about the container wars, and that was less healthy. What is healthy are things like working together in the parts that are not as innovative, right? So Rocket and Docker are both using the core Linux technologies to do as containerization. You know, container namespaces, they're using C groups, they're using, ultimately, right, they're constructing what they're calling a container, but they're constructing a sandbox using the piece of Linux kernel. They're not proprietary pieces that they're using. They're just talking to the Linux kernel and telling the Linux kernel, you know, up these settings in the kernel for my app in a certain way. That's not, you know, competitive, right, space for those two companies, or those not even companies, but projects, right, open source projects. And there's no reason that shouldn't be something they work together on. So, you know, that's what, you know, RunC and, you know, the Open Container Initiative, you know, that's what those things are doing. And I think that's good that there's more cooperation in that space and less competition. It's good that they're competing on, you know, the orchestration and the runtime pieces and the registry. That I think that's all very healthy.
Yeah, and I think I'm with you there. You know, I think somebody asked me one time, they said, is this going to be, you know, who wins the container war? And I said, customers. Like, everybody wins, because we're creating, you know, more push towards other products and supporting, you know, I like how Alex Polvy, he refers to it as filling in the white space around delivering the overall solution. And, you know, so networking and security and orchestration and all of these pieces, like, they just chunk them in, and it's nice to see that it's happening. And whatever, you know, Kubernetes is fitting into it nicely, and there's lots of other products and tools that are being made. Magnum's interesting too. You know, how did you kind of come to say, all right, you know, we need this to fit into OpenStack, and this is, mm-hmm. you know, because you proposed it, you were PTL for the Docker driver for Nova already, and how did Magnum come to be?
Yeah, so when I came into Docker, the Nova Docker driver had already been developed. The developers at Docker that had developed that, you know, were not, you know, hadn't been working in the OpenStack environment really much at all. I mean, they just kind of wrote some code and threw it over the fence, and they're like, okay, great. And the idea of how to maintain that code and the life cycle of that code, I'm not certain, you know, how much it had really been considered, right? You know, I think it was a bit of a shock of, oh wait, you know, we have to maintain this code and do something with it. On the other side was, this code's actually not super useful, right? So we're trying to figure out, how do we make this code useful? And then a lot of pushback on, well, we don't want Nova to do this, right? OpenStack Nova is the compute project. It's this Docker driver is not super useful because it can't do this and it can't do that. And a lot of these really great advantages of Docker can't be realized in Nova. So how do we do that? And, you know, a lot of the conversation was, well, it doesn't belong here. Like, you know, for the design sessions, you know, there's a lot of ideas of it doesn't belong here. We shouldn't extend it over to this. We shouldn't do that. And the questions ultimately came down to, well, what should Nova do? What shouldn't it do? And does it make sense to maybe have a separate project for containers? And, you know, that went on for, you know, a few months, right? You know, I guess two or three summits. I guess technically three summits. Hong Kong was first introduced, which was the Ice House Summit.
Yeah.
And then by Atlanta, the idea was, okay, I think we're pretty much, you know, convinced that this is not going to work as it is. We actually at that point had already had a mid-cycle as well, where we really talked it through. We got in a group, a working group, to figure out what is it that we really need from containers in OpenStack, and then kind of work backwards from there, right? Are these things the things that fit in Nova, or are these things that fit into a different project? And by the way, this container ecosystem is heating up. We have Docker, we have Swarm. This Kubernetes thing looks like it might be taking off. Are we competing with these things? Are we integrating these? How does this work? And of course, the other thing that we considered was, do we need anything at all, right? Are Swarm and Kubernetes enough, and do we not need an OpenStack project? And the consensus became that, yes, there needs to be a project. No, the project doesn't need to do a lot. The project needs to basically be the glue between Nova, Docker, LXC, Kubernetes, Swarm. It needs to be a Neutron, right? Neutron being a big part of this.
Yeah.
That it needs to be the glue, right, that makes these services work. And we're going to make this some sort of elastic container engine, right? And so we come up with this, and we come up with the plans, and the project doesn't make a lot of progress initially, because we still have this matter of like who's going to work on it, and the actual architecture of this, right, is not clearly defined. We have really the use cases and the idea defined, but not necessarily the architecture. So by the time we get to Paris, we have at some point I work on an architecture, and I have that pretty clearly in my head. And somewhere in like the hotel in Paris, I put together a proof of concept and show it to Adrian Otto over at Rackspace. And yeah, so that kind of becomes the first cut in Magnum. And the proof of concept ended up getting rewritten, but that's perfectly fine. Most of the concepts, though, in the architecture remained, and in the end, it just became something that kind of controls either Swarm or controls Kubernetes and integrates with Nova and interfaces with Neutron. And something like a week after, we have all that, in the GitHub repository, and everything's like there's actual code and architecture out in the public. Amazon announces their Elastic Container Service, which thankfully was something very similar. So I was that's actually a good thing, right? It's like earlier, right? Competition's good, and it's not really competitive, right? It's I was very happy that OpenStack ultimately had something that didn't look too different from Amazon's, right? Because if it looked too different, then it wouldn't have been good for the OpenStack ecosystem, because OpenStack is not a really innovative project. It's a glue project that allows people to do stuff they would do on Amazon in their own environment. It really shouldn't be trying to do, something that's wholly unique.
Yeah, and I like it's a good validation. And if, some people, I've had some people comment, they're like, oh, why is it trying to do what AWS does? And that's exactly why, because we like that feature set. We like that functionality. We want that on premises. We want, we're just simply trying to bring the services and the needs and the solutions in-house and, even in public and hybrid and all these different models. So it's, I like the way you think on that one. So, here we are, and I saw when you left Docker, I was like, okay, this is interesting. I know there's some cool stuff coming. And then along came IOPipe. So tell us about IOPipe. What made you make the leap, and what are the goals of, what looks like the start of a project, and I bet it's going to be the start of a good company.
Yeah, so one hopes, especially I do. So I started it in kind of a roundabout way, actually. I actually, rather than starting with how do we approach a serverless problem, I said, how do we approach the problems of IoT? How do we approach some of these problems in our infrastructure and architecture that we have today? And I saw this composability of resources and the sprawl of APIs being an issue. And so I approached it from this really kind of odd angle, right? Especially considering my background. And that probably meant that it took me a little bit longer to get to where I am. But ultimately, I realized that all these problems that I had could be resolved using Lambda functions. And if I have Lambda functions, I can make those serverless functions, and that we could enable developers to solve all these next generation problems using serverless if we give them the right tools. So yeah, I kind of started, I guess, with the problem space, right, and worked back to the solution, thankfully with serverless, because serverless is very aligned with, I guess, my background. But I'm building this tool to enable developers building those next generation apps, and it's the core part about IOPipe is, or maybe things about it, are that it's about composability of functions. So it's not just how do we build serverless functions and serverless applications, but how do we build those in a way where the functions are composable and we can bringing them together to create more compelling applications, right? So not just writing serverless functions that are independent, but serverless functions that act together as a larger application that we can chain together and create pipelines from, for instance, and create ETL pipelines, for instance, or data machine learning pipelines. We can create big data pipelines, right? All with a single serverless coding model.
Do you feel like this is the, where the APIs were, that programmability, in between products and projects was there, and now this is sort of that next, evolution of it? I love the idea of this. You talk about the Lego brick architecture. It's easy to plug in, and then yeah, it's serverless, so there's a lot of opportunities to move it wherever it needs to be with simplicity and very, very lightweight delivery, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, the thing with serverless is that you have lightweight delivery, and you also have 100% resource utilization from the developer perspective, right? So you spawn a function, it runs, it shuts down. That's 100% availability, right? You're not, from an operations standpoint, you're not spinning up a VM and having an event loop that runs 24/7. Your event loop, of course, does exist somewhere, but those functions, like the flames, right? Like the flames of your app, those are entirely running ephemerally in the cloud,
Right.
right? Just that core event loop needs to be somewhere, of course, but sometimes that event loop might not even be your event loop. It might be in a webhook that's triggered from somebody else's service, right? So people build Slack bots, for instance, and their event loop is Slack itself, right? Because they're a Slack bot. Why do they need their own event loop? Their event loop is the Slack architecture that triggers their Slack bot to run on Lambda. It posts a message, it shuts down, and it's done.
It's and the interoperability is always one that's a challenge, I think, for everybody that's getting started. How did you pick the first place to be able to host? Obviously, you talk about Lambda. That's a great place to attach to. If you're going to pick one carriage to hitch your horse to, AWS is the one to start with. But you also have a Google Cloud functions as well, supports out of the gate. How did you come to those, and what do you see as the kind of next steps for where you want to land?
Yeah, so really what we're building is glue, right? We're building the glue so you don't have to build the glue anymore. So you write your application logic, and IOPipe creates the glue automatically, or not automatically, but basically it's like there's an automatic transmission and a manual transmission to IOPipe.
Right.
And if you use the automatic transmission, then you don't have to write glue code anymore. That's the idea, at least. So in doing that, it makes sense that those functions They're highly self-contained, they're highly sandboxed, and they can run anywhere. And AWS Lambda becomes a really obvious place because now we have this cloud bursting, right? So you can build local applications, and wherever that glue is connecting, becomes a point where we can disconnect and run that code somewhere else. So we can run that, instead of running it locally, we can choose to run that code on AWS Lambda. We can run that code on Google Cloud Functions. Those are the two obvious choices, right? For where to run the code. There are other serverless platforms, and there's no reason we wouldn't be able to support those, besides potentially some compatibility issues, that not all the platforms behave the same way. So what we have for that is actually two classes of functions, right? We have functions that can only kind of run in this portable way, and they can run anywhere, and then functions that are like, I hate to say cloud native because it's the wrong term, right? It's platform native, right? Functions that might only work on AWS Lambda, right? And of course, you'll still be able to use those with IOPipe, but they may only work on AWS Lambda. They're not going to work on Google Cloud Functions. Meanwhile, you can also definitely write functions in a way where they're going to run everywhere. And part of that is also providing educational resources so that developers know how to build their functions in a way where they can run anywhere. We're looking at things like where functions will be able to run on GPUs, for instance. So you could burst your functions to a GPU, or you can run them in the cloud. A use case that came to mind, for instance, is image manipulation. So you can run, like, you could build an application, like a function, that if you run it on mobile, it might use the GPU to do image manipulations because mobile doesn't have a lot of power, but they have GPUs, and GPUs have a lot of power for that kind of function, like image manipulation. But if, let's say, you were a image hosting service, it might be more prudent for you to actually do a cloud pipeline for that rather than a GPU pipeline. So you just can spawn up, 10, 100, 1,000 Lambda functions, and that's exact same code without any modification.
Do you
I think I came off your question a little bit, but
No, it's good, and do you see yourself and this type of approach as early, I mean, well, it is early. I'm for a lot of what we call the enterprise crowd, right? But I see also a lot of heat around this type of approach, and I like it. Do you think that this is something that like, how do you coach somebody into saying, hey, you're doing something today, like you said, you're running it in a VM, you're monitoring 24/7, you're waiting for events to happen. Why not move to this serverless approach, event-driven approach? How do we coach people into seeing that this is the right approach to a lot of stuff that's happening today in traditional architecture?
Well, I think the cost savings, right, are really is what's going to push this because you have something like 90 to 100% savings for the developers who are building applications this way rather than running. I mean, think about how much it costs just to, like, I want to build a Slack bot and put it on EC2 instance. It's going to cost me, what, $15, $30 a month to run that so I can have an event loop. If Slack itself is my event loop and it just triggers Lambda functions, that brings it down to like 50 cents, a dollar per month, right? I mean, it's the just the per function count, right, could potentially be kind of high, but it's when these things are happening, especially infrequently, it's much less expensive. And it's also much less expensive than running, like, if you have a highly scaled application, let's say you want to be ready for Black Friday, right? I mean, this Black Friday example is where, like, organizations are really going to see it. Like, they think about how, like, you're a retailer getting ready for Black Friday, you're going to spin up another 100 or 200 or 1,000 machines, right, so you can be ready for Black Friday. And then Black Friday comes, and you hope that it handles all the load, you hope that you scale that enough, and when Black, after Cyber Monday or Cyber Week, you scale things back down again, right? And you're like, okay, now we're go you know now we're back to where we normally are. And meanwhile, you have to monitor all those systems, you have to, all the operational complexity of that. Or you could just be built around Lambda. And when Black Friday hits, you do nothing.
Right.
Right? Just nothing. You
Yeah.
just, oh, great, it's just operating as normal.
Yeah, and even like you said, if it suddenly has to scale because you have massive influx of what will ultimately lead to revenue, right? If you've got application load that's being driven, even if the cost per function is rising, think of what that horizontally scaled EC2 autoscale would look like. It would be equally, expensive and much more expensive because it also it may not respond as quickly. Versus Lambda is, it's there when you need it and it's immediately gone. So the spin up and tear down is immediate. Yeah, it's really, really cool. I like this idea. Do you see, have you had folks sort of resist the concept of serverless and events driven, because they're still having trouble wrapping around fitting it into their architecture?
I think there's a little bit of, how and when do we build new greenfield apps that are going to use this? Require you to greenfield anything, so you can build serverless functions and integrate them into your app and just run them as part of your app. And if later you're ready to go to serverless, you can run those as serverless functions. But you could actually write those functions and run them embedded in your app. Or you could have functions that are like local functions that are actually mapped to Lambda functions, right? So they just transparently just become a function in your app that developer calls, but they're actually calling Lambda, right? It's very transparent. So I think that will help because a big part of it is, well, I have to use the AWS API and APS API tools, right? Like people who wrap around like S3 code, even today, like they'll tell you it's not the most, exhilarating experience, right? It's definitely a different programming model to use, the AWS SDK and the S and S3 than it is to, let's say, open a file with whatever your file system management library is. It's a very different experience. And it's the same thing with Lambda, that it's not as simple as just calling a function. It should be as simple as just calling a function, but right now it's not. IOPipe is trying to solve that problem. There are a couple other libraries that have come and some have gone that have tried to solve that problem already. But yeah, I think that's interesting. And there's also some really compelling use cases for these serverless, and I hate the term serverless, A, because I just don't like the term. But
Technically, it's running on a server somewhere. We just don't handle the server, right?
well, yeah, there's like some trademarking issue, concerns about it, but there's also the fact that, we can run, these are just Lambda functions, right? Like the term Lambda, AWS Lambda, is actually the Lambda part of that is so great because they are Lambda functions and they don't have to run on AWS Lambda, right? They can run embedded in your application.
Right.
We actually, can run those functions on IoT. So you can build a device. You can run, let's say, an IOPipe application on a Raspberry Pi and process events that are actual pin changes on the hardware. And that's your event. And it runs those functions locally. Or it can run them in AWS, right? So you get this really compelling use case of this is actually a way that you can just develop code in the future that, AWS, Lambda Cloud, like on the side, I think this is a new way people are going to develop applications, period, on all platforms.
I love it. Yeah, and agreed. It's we always get stuck with these terms that kind of get attached to a style or an approach, containers, and serverless, and there all these. It's stylistically, yes, it's part of the approach, but yeah, I like that we want to detach from this kind of trademarkish, type of name. So it's definitely interesting. How is your sort of first, brush of with the community going? Have you had a lot of good feedback on the first pass?
Yeah, so there's, it's always going to be mixed, right? I think there were of course, in the first pushes, the first set of code that I threw out there, which was done almost entirely in the open. That thing, the GitHub repo, was private with like 20 pilot users for a month or so, and then I just threw it out open so that it could be available to anyone. But the initial feedback was that it needs to have AWS Lambda integration, right? Initially, it was we can run the functions locally and we can manage those functions. You can download those functions, you can upload those functions, but you can't ship them to AWS, right? So that was like, yeah, that kind of makes sense. Like, we really should have done that. It seems really obvious in retrospect, but at the time, it wasn't. So the AWS Lambda integration actually landed just last week or early this week, like over the weekend. We're still that early, right? But the idea is that, like, there are users today that are having problems with how do we compose these functions and how do we, let's say, spawn a bunch of Lambda functions and then wait for them to respond, like come back to us and finish executing and then consolidate those results and then use them for something.
Right.
IOPipe does all of that today, and it's great for that. And I still see users like building that stuff out on their own, and I'm like, hey, wait, like, we have a library that does that. Like, use the library. There are a lot of places where I think IOPipe, like, we still need to get, the feedback is basically, it would be great if it also did this. And then the response is, great, pull requests accepted.
Yeah.
I'm gonna put it on my roadmap, and I'm gonna try and get that as quickly as possible. But please, pull requests. GitHub.com/IOPipe/IOPipe. Go there, check out the code. Submit some PRs, submit some issues. I'm trying to build a community here. Yes, I'm also trying to build a company, but the open source project and the, are not like, the project came from me and the company came from me, but they're not, they're only so coupled, right? This is something where, Docker always, kept Docker very close to their chest, and sometimes maybe too much so. I'm trying to build an open source project and a community first. And I'm also building a company, but that company's intention, the goal of that company is not to drive an open source project.
Right.
The goal of that company is to build value, for its users and value, of course, for its investors as well. But the goal of that company is not to manage an open source project, right? So the open source project belongs to its community, and we need to build that community. So whatever IOPipe doesn't do, the feedback is always great. It should do that. Let's add it. Let's get, work together and make those things happen.
Nice. Excellent. Well, we're winding up on time, but Eric, I want to thank you very much for taking the time to chat today, and wish you luck with the future of this. We'll hope to drive a lot of eyes to what you're doing with IOPipe and both as a project and as a company. I want to see successes on both sides. It's nice to see folks that have, and you've been a great community contributor, and I love that your focus is on that. It really, really helps to differentiate how some sharing goes on. It has a much, you said we can't be completely altruistic. We've got to pay rent and other expenses. But I love that your focus is community, and the secondary piece, which, is the corporate side of it that we have to maintain. But again, thanks for taking the time today. How do we get folks to get a hold of you if they wanted to chat more and find out more about IOPipe?
Yeah, so, first of all, there's a website, iopipe.com. And then my email address, you can, I'm really asking for it now, right? Going to give my email address, eric@iopipe.com. That's Eric with a C. And there's also Twitter, of course, which is ewindish, ewindish. And Twitter, email, the website, GitHub, GitHub.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. GitHub.com/IOPipe. Get in there and submit PRs and help to drive this community. I'm excited by the future for it. Are we going to see you at any events in the coming weeks and months? Are because you've shifted away from OpenStack and containers, are you going to be at the OpenStack Summit and other events like that?
So I'm actually speaking at Serverless Conf. So there is a Serverless Conference in New York City, May. It's late May, I think the 26th or 27th. But that's I think serverlessconf.com. So that's a great new conference that's going to pop up, and I'll speak. I may be at OpenStack. I haven't quite decided yet, but I will. I will be thinking about it. It for me, it's a matter of establishing the value,
Right.
because we're early in a project and making sure that project is successful, and making sure that our company is successful. And I have to weigh the pros and cons of the opportunity cost of attending any conference.
Exactly. Well, serverless conf, we'll make sure we put in links in the show notes for folks who want to come and see you speak there. That'll be great. So again, Eric Windisch, thank you very much for chatting with us today. For folks that wanted to talk more, you can keep the conversation going in the Green Circle community. Just go to greencircle.vmturbo.com. Again, I'm Eric Wright. You can reach me. I'm at Disco Posse on Twitter. That's the easiest way to track me down. And thank you again, Eric Windisch. We will be looking for the best in the future for IO Pipe.
Thank you very much for having me. This is great.
Thanks.